forces behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices.
According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbors. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Saied has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods, such as fuel and bread. Saied has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 500 Iranian enterprises and companies gathered to take part in an award ceremony that is expected to up their games and also allow them to gain a foothold in the OIC economy. Nearly 150 of them passed the quality control test to acquire four-star status, the highest defined by the Standard and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries, also referred to as SMIC.
This award, or better said, the four-star certificate, represents the highest standard of Iranian products, according to OIC member states. It will allow our companies to export their goods and services to OIC member states and also improve market conditions and competitiveness.
The standards bring the specification of the products. If you know what is the products, what ingredients, what the specification of the products, you can easily trade. And this brings also international recognition of the products, and free trade will bring the remove the barriers.
The companies that were awarded the certificate and acquired the four-star status couldn't agree more.
I believe that the true award is the trust that our customers have in our products. The fact that they believe our name stands for high-quality products, for me, is more valuable than any award or certificate.
The companies that are active in food industries definitely require international standards, and for OIC member states, the halal standard is of great importance. We tried very hard to reach this level and gain the 4 stars and the halal certificate.
The Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is the most important organization in compiling standards in the fields of food, health, and tourism management systems accepted by 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most active members of the Technical Committee of SMIC. As an institute developing the necessary mechanisms in the OIC, the Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is paving the way for member states to recognize each other's standard certificates. This will in turn help to boost trade. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration or harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Is GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is there for all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adhering to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands, as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade, as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi prime minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
On Thursday, tens of thousands of rail workers in Italy staged a day-long walkout over pay and safety at work, hampering public transportation services and tourists' access to their destinations. The strike action, called by the three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, caused cancellations and delays to national and regional trains at the peak of the country's booming high tourist season. Italy, like much of Europe, is suffering from high inflation and stagnant economic growth, and unions are protesting against low wages, especially in relation to the ongoing increase in the cost of living.
Today's action revolves around two issues. We demand an adjustment of the collective pay agreements for our sector and more hiring to ease pressure on employees and their unsustainable workloads. Furthermore, more investments on railway maintenance are needed. Last-minute negotiations with the Transport Ministry failed on Tuesday. The government showed up too late.
Also, air transport workers are set to down tools on Saturday despite Transport Minister Matteo Salvini's attempts to persuade unions to call off the strikes. This new industrial action, the latest in a long line of transport strikes, is widely expected to be more disruptive than most, which are generally only backed by one or two major unions. Commuters are once again facing delays and cancellations. They are saying they are at the end of their rope.
Disruptions keep affecting us. It's not just about tourists. Commuters are those who are bearing the brunt for the mismanagement of our public transport system. This way, they force people to resort to their cars.
Workers' wages in Italy are excessively low. I understand those who are staging the strike. As a result, commuters are left to face the music.
About 90% of rail transport sector workers joined the strike called by CGL, CISL and WIL unions. Even high-speed lines that are usually guaranteed during Italy's frequent work stoppages were affected. Max Civili, Rome.
A familiar sight as the summer of strikes and disruptions in England rolls on. While some health workers have settled, junior doctors, who form 40% of the workforce in the National Health Service here, are still locked in a bitter war of words with the government. They say the request of a 35% pay rise is an opening offer and accuse the government of negotiating in bad faith. And while the deadlock continues, it's the patients who are paying the price as hundreds of thousands of appointments and operations are postponed, despite Prime Minister Rishi Sunak setting cutting the NHS waiting list, now at more than 7 million, as a top priority.
The government argues that any pay rises funded through borrowing for these junior doctors or others in the public sector risk fueling the inflation that's highest among the G7 advanced economies. But not everyone agrees with that.
The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it.
As the strike got underway, an announcement by the Prime Minister saying his government's offer for pay rises was the last such offer and that there would be no more negotiations with the unions. But with the tens of thousands of nurses and doctors having quit last year, the strikers say the pay rises are needed to keep them in the profession.
People are leaving the profession and we're losing staff. They're going across to Australia, New Zealand, America to get paid more money. But also within the UK, they're taking on more private work, equivalent private work.
This month, we'll also see disruption under railways as an overtime ban for train drivers comes into force and as staff walk off altogether yet again. For the time being, disputes dragging on, plenty of problems for the government, few simple solutions. Saipur is up, London.
Common wound among the Iranian and Japanese nation. Following the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Sardash became the third city to endure an attack by a weapon of mass destruction. Sardash, the first city to suffer a chemical attack, hosted a Japanese diplomatic delegation to commemorate the victims of this assault. According to Shiva, the wife of one of the victims of Sardash, her husband is still suffering from the consequences of the attack that occurred 36 years ago.
Because of the sanctions, I can't get the appropriate medicine for my husband. He has been suffering from chemo for a long time.
36 years ago, Western countries, including the United States, England, and Germany, provided Iraqi dictator Saddam with chemical weapons, which he used on Iranian people. This action has not been condemned by any human rights body in the world. Mr. Murakami from the Japanese delegation emphasized the importance of telling the world about the crimes that took place in Sardash, saying this was the reason for their visit to the town.
I think it is important for the world to get to know about what happened in Sardash some 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's very important for me to really come visit this place.
The international community has turned a blind eye on this brutal chemical attack in the last 36 years. We can hope such meetings and gatherings can pave the way to raise the voice of the victims of this brutal attack. Farzana Shirin, Sardash.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Mortgage lenders in Britain have raised interest rates again in recent weeks. In the current situation, home buyers and homeowners are struggling with increasing loan costs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website This Is Money has covered this story and tells us more. It was revealed on Friday, 16th of June, that Britain's homeowners are now spending more income on their mortgage than at any time since 2008, as average interest rates closed in on 6%. According to trade body UK Finance, repayments on new loans accounted for an average of 20% of borrowers' gross incomes between January and April. This is up from 17% in 2020, and is now at the highest level since it hit 23% during the financial crisis. Furthermore, the latest data covered a period that came before the huge rise in the mortgage rates, which only began 3 weeks ago. The rates increase has continued recently, with the average two-year fixed mortgage jumping again to 5.98% on Friday, 16th of June, from 5.92% on Thursday, 15th of June. Friday's 0.06 percentage point rise in the biggest increase between working days since Friday, 2nd of June, and Monday, 5th of June, when it went up from 5.64% to 5.72%. The two-year rate is up 0.63 percentage points from 5.35% 3 weeks ago, 0.34 percentage points from 5.64% a fortnight ago, and 0.15 percentage points from 5.83% a week ago. Elliot Cully, director of Switch Mortgage Finance on Hayling Island in Hampshire, said recently, "With mortgage rates now starting with a 5 instead of a 4, it is getting harder and harder for clients to stomach the new monthly payments." Elliot Cully said, "Most clients are wanting short-term fixed interest rates at the moment, with forecasts expecting a reduction in interest rates over the next 18 months. He added, "But these come at a cost, and as a result, some borrowers are resorting to extending the mortgage term. In most cases, this is with the plan to reduce the term again when interest rates reduce." Cully added, "There will be some borrowers who don't have the option to extend the term, and if interest rates rise much further, there is a greater chance of people having to seek assistance from their current lender." Mortgage interest rates data provided by financial expert at MoneyFacts also revealed the average five-year fixed rate in mortgage rose to 5.62% on Friday, 16th of June, up from 5.56% on Thursday, 15th of June. The rate is now up 0.6 points from 5.02% 3 weeks ago, 0.3 percentage points from 5.32% 2 weeks ago, and 0.14 percentage points from 5.48% 1 week ago. Meanwhile, the number of mortgage products available fell to 4,923 on Friday, 16th of June, from 5,082. A daily fall of 159, which takes it back to levels last seen on 8th of June. Lenders are scrambling to reprice mortgage deals as finance markets bet on further Bank of England rate increases to tackle inflation. Ross Lacey, director and chartered financial planner at Fairview Financial Management in Rayleigh, Essex, said the aim of the Bank of England's increases to interest rates is to bring down inflation. She added, given that mortgages still make up a large part of household expenditure, the thought process is that if borrowers are having to allocate a greater portion of their income to their mortgage payments, they will reduce spending elsewhere. She added, this hasn't been seen to the extent expected as yet, as many are still on sub-2% fixed-rate mortgages. She claimed, we've been helping our clients remortgage onto the most competitive rates available, reducing their loan-to-value if possible, and increasing the term of their borrowing, which all goes some way to offsetting the effect of higher interest rates. The latest turbulence sent yields on two-year gilts, the rate investors charged to lend to the government, to a fresh 15-year high on Thursday, 15th of June. 5- and 10-year gilt yields are at highs not seen since last autumn's mini-budget. Experts are warned of a huge week for mortgages as the latest inflation rate is released in the coming days before any change to the Bank of England's base rate. Gary Bush, financial advisor at MortgageShop.com in Potter's Bar in Hertfordshire, said mortgage lenders tweaking upwards twice in a week their fixed rates, sometimes more frequently, has caused chaos with applicant transactions. Gary Bush added, a rise of fixed on the inflation announcement in the coming days, and this will be the driver for the all-important Bank of England Monetary Committee meeting, and indeed, the swap market thereafter. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. Graham Cox, the founder of SelfEmployedMortgageHub.com in Bristol, said rates have soared in the past couple of weeks, drastically hitting mortgage affordability and reducing maximum loan amounts. Much will depend on whether the inflation outlook improves over the coming months. He added, if mortgage rates stay at these levels for any length of time, then very significant house price falls are likely, perhaps 20% or even more over the next couple of years. Jonathan Burridge, founding advisor at We Are Money in London, said few predictions at the start of the year saw this latest round of interest rate rises, mortgage rate rises, and that should serve to warn borrowers that no one knows the future. All forecasts prove to be wrong or lucky. He added, there will be great many people worried about their mortgage costs rising, so they should be engaging in review as soon as possible. Borrowers should try not to panic. We cannot control interest rates, but term extensions or changes to repayment methods may alleviate some financial pressure. Financial markets suggest the Bank of England's base rate now has a 1-in-3 chance of hitting 6% by the end of the year. And Rob Gill, Managing Director of Altura Mortgage Finance in London, told Mail Online on Friday, we're seeing an increasing number of remortgage borrowers seeking advice on not just the lowest available rate, but also how to restructure their mortgage to lower their monthly payments. He added, paying down their mortgage, increasing the term, and making all or part of the mortgage interest only are all options that can be explored. He said the right advice to discuss longer-term plans with clients, including how they will eventually pay off the mortgage or meet mortgage payments if the term extends into retirement, needs to be sought by borrowers considering such options. Mark Carney, the former Bank of England governor, has dampened hopes that the current period of soaring borrowing costs, which is adding thousands to families' annual repayments, would be temporary. He said homeowners who fix their loans at low interest rates just at the right time should be aware that they will still face a big jump in payments when they conclude. His warning came as a key advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, rate setters should keep doling out the medicine of interest rate hikes to save the disease of higher inflation worsening. Next week, the Bank of England is expected to go for another quarter of a percentage point hike, taking its benchmark rate to 4.75%.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Press TV Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, tensions are rising in many points around the world as a tug of war between the old and new guard increases. As the unipolar world dissolves into a multipolar one, the U.S. continues to hold on and flex its muscle to try to intimidate. Now, North Korea is the latest country to be targeted and demonized as an aggressor, as Washington has sent a nuclear submarine to South Korea, which happens to be 6,600 miles away from its own border, but right on side of the north. So should Pyongyang be concerned? We're going to look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to introduce my guest now to the program. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History, New Mexico State University, out of New Mexico. And William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off in New Mexico. And Ken, why is the, I'm sorry, I'll start off with William. Why is the United States so, well, never mind, actually, because I'll tell you, Ken, I didn't have your image, so I wasn't sure you were with me. So going back to Ken, why is the United States so antagonistic towards North Korea?
Well, this, of course, is a legacy that goes back for more than 70 years. You know, North Korea has, been autonomous. It has been self-sufficient. They have been very self-reliant, building a society that is, you know, devoted to taking care of their own people. But they have been completely unwilling to subordinate themselves to the international system of imperialism and capitalism. And, of course, they've had this antagonistic relationship with the American-backed government in the southern half of the peninsula. That is a legacy of the war back in the early 1950s, a legacy of the division of the peninsula at the end of World War II. The United States has always maintained an incredibly aggressive posture towards North Korea. North Korea simply acts to protect itself, to defend itself. But everything it does in that regard is presented by the United States as if it's as if North Korea is being the aggressive, disruptive party, when in fact they're simply trying to protect themselves from the very, very real threat of the United States, which maintains tens of thousands of troops in the South, and as you just mentioned, is even carrying out these kinds of remarkable provocations like sending a nuclear-armed submarine right into South Korean ports with the clear message that, you know, this is directed against the North.
Well, William, do you think that North Korea is a threat to South Korea?
Well, it's a complicated situation, but let's put it briefly here that what the U.S. policy is a renuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The fact of the deployment of this nuclear-armed submarine in South Korea means that there's an end to the so-called denuclearization policy, which had been in place for several decades, with a good deal of success during the Trump administration when there were negotiations with the head of the DPRK. That has all finished with the onset of the Biden administration, and they are also now playing hardball. In diplomacy, you usually like to have carrots and sticks, but the Biden administration only knows the sticks, and therefore they're sending the nuclear submarine to South Korea after an agreement with the South Korean president to initiate a new nuclear agreement, making South Korea actually a part of a nuclear defense platform. And that's a very serious situation because that affects not only the Korean Peninsula and its future, but the future of Asia. And you cannot forget that while these the submarine is in South Korea ostensibly to defend against North Korea, it is also very much a problem for the People's Republic of China. And I think that is a part of the equation of the United States, which is trying to restore its hegemony, its control over the Asia-Pacific region, that they are utilizing this so-called North Korean threat in an attempt to contain China. So it's not only Kim Jong-un that should be feel threatened by this, but also China. China has also close relations with North Korea. It's been relatively supportive of it in the difficult situation has found itself. China has often been one of the few allies. Russia also is relations with North Korea. But the West, aside from the very small measures that were taken during the Trump administration, has been antagonistic to them. And they therefore are in a situation, as the other speaker said, trying to find a means of defending themselves against an outside threat.
Well, Ken, whether it's North Korea or China or Russia, and the United States continue to flex its muscle with each one, how much of this has to do with the U.S.'s waning influence in general?
Oh, I think basically all of it has to do with that. You know, the United States has been at the heart of the global system of capitalism and imperialism, certainly since the end of World War II, and most particularly, of course, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the first Cold War. But as the United States has you know, faltered, as the American economy has declined and as social problems in the United States have escalated, political fragmentation in the United States has escalated, and as other parts of the world, most notably perhaps China, but certainly countries like Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, you know, have begun to become more prosperous, have begun to pursue their own paths of modernization, industrialization, economic development, raising the material standards of life for their people, enhancing the livelihoods of their people. The United States, the political elites and economic elites in the U.S. see that as a threat to their power, their privileges, the positions that they've held. So that's what really drives all of this is you know, the United States is not particularly economically competitive anymore. It can't hold itself up as much of a model anymore. What it has is military muscle, military might. And that is what drives a lot of American policy, and certainly what drives the antagonism towards China. And the antagonism to North Korea is not just an extension of that, but certainly, as William was saying, they're all tied in together. So I think that, yeah, that it's the decline, it's the erosion of American power and prestige, and a fairly desperate and reckless set of efforts to try to hang on and maintain that hegemonic position.
Well, William, Washington and Seoul have started this consultative body now, arranging a coordinated action to a nuclear war scenario. I mean, does this help cool off the situation or exacerbate the situation? And tell me about South Korea in general. Do they have a choice not to go along with the United States in all of this?
Yeah, for the second question, yes, absolutely, they could have done that. And under the former president, I'm sure that they would not have done that. But President Yoon has a different policy. He is tilting toward the United States, wants a closer economic relationship with them, maybe also a little concerned about the growing might of China, which plays a very important role in the South Korean economy. So he has moved in the direction of trying to be a part of this operation quasi-military coalition that the United States is trying to create in the Asia Pacific. I don't know if his position is so terribly strong among the population. There is a lot of criticism with regard to that. Also, the fact that President Yoon spent the time after his visit to Vilnius at the NATO summit to make a secret visit to Kiev at the time that there were tremendous flooding in South Korea. Even before he went to Kiev, this was a problem. And instead of going back and dealing with that crisis, he wanted to play this game of assuring Ukraine that they would also get military equipment in South Korea. I think that also damaged him somewhat, and he went back and began to blame the authorities for not doing enough in that tragedy. But I think some of the blame is going to be attached to him, and that could have political implications as well. I don't think that there's general unanimity within the Korean population with regard to becoming a satrap for the United States in the Asia Pacific, directed against China and against Russia. So I don't think that's going to hold in the long run with regard to South Korea.
Well, Ken, how should North Korea take this statement released by South Korea's defense ministry? The submarine's visit is a demonstration of U.S. resolve in implementing its extended deterrence commitment, a pledge by the U.S. to use its full military capabilities, including nuclear weapons, to protect its allies.
Well, again, the only people on the peninsula that really need protecting are the people of North Korea. They're the ones who face, you know, embargoes, sanctions, you know, the relentless hostility of the United States and of its minion government in the South. So this is a classic sort of rhetorical inversion, if you will, where the United States and the government in South Korea project onto the other side the behavior which they themselves are pursuing. You know, so it is the United States and South Korea that have this hostile attitude towards the North, but they turn that around and try to present the North as if they are the aggressors, as if they are the ones who are posing the threat. Yes, North Korea has had a nuclear program, but they need that in order to deter American imperialism. When we look at other countries that have, for example, Libya, that made the mistake of giving up any you know, credible threat or credible deterrent effect of their own nuclear programs, that didn't work out very well for them. And North Korea is very very sensitive to those historical experiences and the lessons that need to be drawn from them.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
William, how, according to North Korean leader's sister and policy chief Kim Yo-jung, the U.S. want to hold talks, but it wants Pyongyang to denuclearize and to disarm in exchange for sanctions relief. She said that will never happen because the U.S. cannot be trusted with its promises. Your thoughts on that?
Well, she's probably got a basis for making the statements, obviously. But we did see a situation at one point during the Trump administration that where North Korea was prepared to discuss these issues. The question is, the real question is, you go one of two ways, that if you continue in this direction, you're going to have a nuclear apparatus in the Asia-Pacific region. You will have other countries having nuclear weapons. Ultimately, you probably have South Korea having its own nuclear weapons, and believe me, also Japan is moving in that direction. So that could be a very dicey situation. There is another alternative that was discussed, you know, several years ago with regard to the DPRK, that if you could create a firm security architecture within the region, and that architecture would have to include not only the DPRK, but also China, and probably also Russia, as well as the United States, then there would be a possibility of creating peace in the region without every country moving for nuclear weapons. That has really been off the table for quite some time, and I don't see any indication in the Biden policy that that's going to happen. But you never know what the situation will be like. Right now, the U.S. seems to be in the driver's seat. But the ferment and the instability that we also saw at the Vilnius summit, and that was arguments over many different questions, indicates that this colossus of NATO is much weaker than people think. And in many countries, there are major demonstrations against the government policy. And in that situation, I think you're having a coalition of Russia and China, plus the third world countries, which is becoming a major force in determining what the world will look like. And President Xi's idea of the Global Security Initiative has gotten a lot of support. And something like that, which would be put in place, a security architecture in the Asia-Pacific region without nuclear weapons, would be a possibility. But we have a long way to go in that because of the tensions that the U.S. is fomenting and promoting by its own policy of maintaining hegemony or attempting to maintain hegemony in the region.
Well, Ken, do you think that Washington benefits from the Koreas being separated into North and South, that as a matter of fact, it wants to have this tension between these two entities? Otherwise, do you see it as a possibility that actually there could be unification?
Well, I think that the hope for unification is something that is shared by many people on both sides or at both ends of the peninsula. Certainly, many people in the South, many families, of course, were divided at the time of the war. And although there have been moments where, family reunions have been possible and there have been movements from time to time back and forth across the border, that separation, you know, has now gone on for a couple of generations, and it's very, very stressful, and it's very, very, you know, it's a tragic situation for many ordinary people, and I think there's a real yearning for unification. The Korean Peninsula, the Korean people have a very, very long history of being a single country, a single society. So I think that there's a tremendous desire for unification. But the United States is unwilling to compromise on things, you know. And I think that, again, the hostility towards the North has to be seen in the larger geopolitical context with China's rise and with the American and NATO-driven hostility towards Russia. North Korea, you know, to the degree to which North Korea has made overtures to the South, sometimes when there have been more liberal or more progressive leaders in the South, there's been some engagement. Now, of course, we're in a very, very negative period. The United States, I think, wants to kind of keep that churning, because that instability, that tension is itself in American interests as far as being able to present the United States as the umbrella of security, being able to say, we're going to insert this nuclear armed submarine as a deterrent. You know, it allows the United States to play a certain role, even though it's a vacuous facade. But it's what allows the United States to continue to propagate this sort of mythology of its role in the Western Pacific.
Well, that's interesting, because, William, if we look at the situation, as you've already discussed, the increased tension and also possibility of more countries wanting nuclear weapons because of this increased tension. So it's like a catch-22. The United States is there. It increases the tension. On the one hand, it shows that it is needed in the region. But on the other hand, it's increasing a lot of insecurity. Very simplistic sounding question, but I'm going to pose it anyway. Why wouldn't the United States? You had mentioned, for example, a plan earlier that was mentioned in opening up the situation for North Korea and having regional countries and also the United States and all working together and sharing in the economic benefit and prosperity and sort of helping each other and getting along. Why won't the United States go in that direction when it sees that it is not getting anywhere in this other direction, but we see it all over the world replaying out?
Well, as Churchill said at one point, the United States will do everything before it. It will try every solution before it comes to the right solution. I think there has to be probably a dramatic shift here in one way or another to indicate that this policy is ultimate folly. There also has to be more pressure in the United States. Unfortunately, it's taken a long time to get any kind of a peace movement going here recently after the Ukraine war began. But I think that you will see that happening, and that will change the internal dynamic within the United States, where this policy is no longer acceptable to the U.S. China, and in particular, has been talking about this notion of security structure in the Asia-Pacific region. The Global Security Initiative that Xi is putting forward most recently is also an indication of that. And that has tremendous support. It has tremendous support in Asia. If you look at the ASEAN countries in particular, that there is a great deal of support for this, in contrast to the kind of geopolitical maneuvering and conflicts which are occurring as a result of U.S. policy. How that will go in the United States is hard to say, but I think they're going to either reach a brick wall in trying to pursue this policy, because